And also, like, Ellie, when I take questions, I'm going to repeat them for the recorder. So just the same person, basically. I'm Holden. I'm co-founder with Ellie of GiveWell. And, you know, I'm here to talk about the Open Philanthropy Project, which is a project that is spinning out of GiveWell. So we've been running as part of the same organization for the last few years, and now we're in the midst of sort of a legal transition. To put it as on the quick side, what Open Philanthropy Project is, it is similar to GiveWell in that we look for the ways to do as much good as possible by giving. It is different in that we target major high net worth donors who are highly engaged, rather than targeting like a large number of individual donors who might have a few hours a year to decide where to give. And the reason we do things this way, basically in 2011, when we were running GiveWell, we met Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz. Dustin's co-founder of Facebook and Asana, and they were kind of trying to figure out how to give away a very large amount of money over the course of their lifetimes as do as much good as possible. And this was obviously related to the thing we were already doing, but also a very different and interesting challenge. And so we started working together then. We still work together, and the Open Philanthropy Project is the name of our partnership. And so basically what the Open Philanthropy Project is we are trying to, you know, figure out what we can do as kind of a large philanthropist, giving a really large amount of money over the next several decades to do as much good as possible. And then we also want to share our findings with the world. Although in practice, that does look different from GiveWell, because I'd say with GiveWell, usually, you know, all of the reasoning is available online, and basically every statement that's made, you can see why it's made. And as you're going to hear with Open Philanthropy, a lot of times we get very deep into kind of expertise rabbit holes, and it isn't practical to share everything going into our decisions, but we still try to share a lot of our thinking, and therefore inform other people, because one of the things that motivated the formation of the Open Philanthropy Project was this fact that, just like with GiveWell, if you're looking for how to give well, there's very little to read. There's very little existing wisdom out there. There's basically no scholarship devoted to it. And there's just little to go on in terms of getting up to speed and figuring out, okay, what are the different approaches to doing this well and which one should I take? So that's what we are. In terms of what we've done, so first off, a couple of differences to highlight with GiveWell. GiveWell looks for things that are proven, cost-effective, and scalable, and those criteria are optimized for individual donors. They're optimized for the kind of person who might say, you know, I want to give this year, I have a few hours to decide, and I want something that can be explained, something that makes sense, something that can be vetted, something I can be confident in. By contrast, Open Philanthropy, instead of focusing on organizations, instead of looking for charities people can give to, we really think about which causes to work on, and we try to work in areas or on issues that we call important, neglected, and tractable. So important means it affects a lot of people, and it you know, there's an issue that is a big deal that affects a lot of people, and it affects them a lot. Neglected means it's not already covered, and so we look for things where we can add special value. They don't already have a lot of philanthropy working on them. And then tractables means we see kind of a path to actually getting something accomplished. But, you know, one of the big differences is we often are interested in things that are more long-term and harder to measure and inherently just riskier and more uncertain than anything GiveWell does, because, you know, we are able to hire staff, we're able to build our own trust relationships, and we're able often to get to the point where we feel we have kind of a cutting edge understanding of an issue that would be very hard to write up and very hard to like make a full case for publicly, but that is kind of world class or cutting edge, and that therefore we're willing to try things that other people won't try and to do things that may not make sense to everyone in the world. And so it's a very different philosophy of giving. And one of the posts that I think, you know, really illustrates how we think is this blog post called Hits-Based Giving. That really makes the case that, you know, a lot of what we do, it's like we might fail 9 times out of 10 when we try to get something done, but 1 time out of 10 we'll have the kind of success that makes up for everything else. And it kind of takes inspiration from a lot of the best philanthropy in the past, where people kind of took an issue where they thought they had a special edge, a special insight. They took a big risk. A lot of times they failed. But when they succeeded, we got things like the Green Revolution or the pill or other things that, you know, that I think philanthropy has been very impressive at. And if you want a list of them, they're, you know, our conference rooms are named after some of these successes. So I can explain those if anyone wants to raise your hand about one of them. So those are some of the core philosophical differences between the two organizations. A lot of times in the first session of this kind of event, people will, you know, will kind of ask about GiveWell, well, aren't you missing good things that you can't measure? Whereas in this part of the event, people will often ask, well, how could you do something that wacky that'll never work? And so, you know, it's kind of these two ends of a spectrum, and they both take kind of a, you know, extreme principled position on one end or the other. In terms of what we've done to date at Open Philanthropy Project, so our first couple of years, we're getting our bearings and also picking issues to focus on, picking focus areas. So one of the, you know, core building blocks of our work, of our philanthropy, is picking a limited number of issues to focus on so that we can really get deep into them, so that we can have contacts, so that we can have networks, so that we can have good relationships with people who tell us the truth, so that we can understand all of the difficult issues, all of the literature. And so, for example, you know, one of our focus areas is criminal justice reform, and our work is led by Chloe Coburn, who we hired from the ACLU, and she brings kind of a career in criminal justice reform and knows everyone in the space, knows all the arguments, knows all the issues, knows all the players, the, you know, the papers, or knows someone who knows those things, and so is able to kind of often see ahead of the rest of the field, see what others can't see, and that's kind of the philosophy. And so, you know, our first couple of years were spent picking focus areas. Like I said, we looked for things that were important, neglected, tractable. We followed a cause selection process where we kind of did investigations of increasing depth. On, you know, as a cause looked promising, we would get to know it more. And eventually, once we picked the causes that we wanted to focus on, we basically spent 2015, last year, on hiring. And so, you know, we picked a bunch of causes. We tried to hire the best possible people we could find to lead our work in those causes. And then in 2016, our focus has really been on grant making. And so, you know, you can see it. I think when we put out our reports, you'll see it in the numbers that I estimate that there was something like $15 million in grants recommended in 2015, and those were all very exploratory, and those were all kind of trying to get to know a focus area, or trying to get to know a space, and in the process making some grants that we came across. Whereas for 2016, I'm going to guess that it's going to come to something more like $100 million total in grant making, and that's, you know, that's grant making made by Good Ventures, by the, you know, by Carrie and Dustin. And it's made at the recommendation and based on the research of the Open Philanthropy Project, and it does not include donations to top charities or anything on the GiveWell side. It's just things that we're doing. And so, you know, our focus this year has been, we have built out our staff a lot last year. This year we focused on giving. And just to give a quick overview of the areas we work in, some of the stuff we've done, and then what's next, and then I'll take questions for the rest of the time. But, you know, so one of the areas that I mentioned, criminal justice reform. This is an area we picked because out of all the kind of policy advocacy issues we might work on, when we're looking for things that are important, neglected, and tractable, criminal justice reform really stood out on tractability. We saw sort of political opportunities there that we didn't see in other causes. And actually, I think if you look at most of the, you know, sort of big policy issues in the U.S., a lot of them at this point look really hard to get anywhere on anytime soon. And a lot of that is because a lot of the most important issues are just federal issues. And so, you know, the dynamic in Washington, D.C. is pretty tough and pretty adversarial right now. Criminal justice reform is a state and local issue. It gives us an ability to pick our battles more. We do believe that across the board, across the states, across the localities, incarceration is at historically extreme levels, globally extreme levels. The U.S. just incarcerates an extreme number of people. And we believe, based on our best read of the literature, which I'm happy to answer questions about, that we're not getting a public safety benefit commensurate with all the pain and suffering and expense of the amount we put people in prison and jail. And so, you know, when looking for ways to create a more humane, a more sane system that kind of does a better job balancing public safety with the fact that we don't want to incarcerate people for no reason, you know, we have like I said, it's at the state and local level, and so we have a large variety of different places we can go and opportunities we can look for. And in addition, I think this issue, you know, is an area where public opinion is changing and that is a little bit less prone to the usual partisan battles than other issues. So, you know, it's an opportunity where if you want to help the worst off people and you want to cut the size of government, those are often the same thing when it comes to criminal justice reform. It's an area where there is a growing consensus that, you know, of which direction we can move, and it's not just the left and it's not just the right. So that is an area we work on. I mentioned Chloe, who we hired to lead that work, and she, you know, she has really led our work, and the general way that we've done grant making is we try to find the best people, and then they, you know, the best people for this job, for this role, and then they really lead the process of deciding what their priorities are, what grants they want to propose, what grants they want to advocate for. And Carrie and I are more at the level of asking critical questions, reviewing internal write-ups, but really letting the specialized staff lead the way. And so under Chloe's direction, we've made, you know, a variety of grants. Some of them are for very action-oriented short-term things, like a campaign to close Rikers Island in New York, one of the sort of infamous jails. And we believe that closing it would require policy reforms that would lead to fewer people in jail. So the goal is not just to move people from Rikers to somewhere else. Also the Alliance for Safety and Justice is a group that has spun out of Californians for Safety and Justice. Californians for Safety and Justice was behind two of the biggest criminal justice reform sort of successes in the last few years, Prop 47 and Prop 57, both in California. And they're trying to take their work national now and look all across the country for opportunities to get similar wins. And so we've been one of the biggest funders of Alliance for Safety and Justice. And we've also funded work that is more long-term and more speculative in a sense. So we funded some work around restorative justice, which is sort of an attempt to find an alternative to putting people in jail and in prison, to take someone who's committed a crime and have them reach an agreement with the victim of the crime that can serve a lot of the goals we might have for jail and prison, which is having people face up to what they did, make them less likely to do it again, but not all the same costs. So we've, you know, been investing in sort of groups that are experimenting with that approach, piloting it, see if it can work practically and politically and what the results might be. Another cause that we have prioritized, that we've hired for, farm animal welfare. So, you know, I think that, there's an enormous number of animals being raised on factory farms for food. I think that they're treated incredibly badly. I think it's quite an eye-opener if you ever read about how animals are treated on factory farms. And, you know, I think there's definitely a lot of animal welfare groups out there. Most of them do not prioritize factory farmed animals. And, you know, when I look at this cause, it's an interesting one because it's not straightforward to say how important it is. I think people really have different opinions of how to compare, you know, animals to humans in terms of who should we, you know, in terms of the value of the suffering, in terms of how much we should care about reducing suffering. I certainly believe, and I think most people would believe, that, you know, we should care more about humans, but there is a question of how much. So, you know, one of the things that I have kind of learned about farm animal welfare is that it's a very neglected cause. There's very little money in it. There's very little attention to it. And as we've stepped in, we've seen a huge amount of tractability and a huge number of victories. And so, you know, I'd say over the past year, there's been a series of pledges by grocers, by fast food companies, to sell only cage-free eggs. And these pledges have gotten to the point of basically covering all of America. This could affect billions of chickens and take them, you know, I would say from conditions that are unacceptable to conditions that are still unacceptable, but no longer involve a cage, and that I think are significantly better. And, you know, it's interesting because while with GiveWell Top Charities, the best we can do is sort of $2,000-$3,000 per death averted. With farm animal welfare, we might be looking at something like 50 or 100 chickens out of cages per $1 spent. And so, you know, I certainly believe that humans count for more than animals in a moral calculus. But when you ask the question of how much more, it becomes very murky when you're dealing with a multiplier like that, a multiplier in the range of 10,000 or something. And so this is one of these cases where, you know, I don't have a firm view, but I definitely feel there's an argument that we should feel this is incredibly important and incredibly overlooked opportunity to reduce a huge amount of suffering. And I think we've seen a lot of victories, and our priority so far has largely been funding attempts to get corporate reform, so to get fast food companies, grocers, to commit to treat animals better. And I think that has the advantage both of reducing suffering pretty directly and pretty quickly, and also establishing some wins and establishing some momentum for what I hope is a growing field that will eventually get us to a point where, you know, where I feel okay about the way animals are treated who are being eaten, and I currently don't. So that's, you know, that's a major priority. Another focus area of ours, biosecurity and pandemic preparedness. So, you know, this kind of fits into the category of global catastrophic risks. I think one really interesting place for philanthropy to work is to look at risks to global civilization. Things that, you know, may be very unlikely, but if they got bad enough, could kind of threaten the whole interconnected civilization we live in. This is the kind of thing that no one government, no one company really has the incentive to think about. We're looking at, you know, really low probability, really huge deal for everyone kind of situations. And so I think there are some really interesting gaps for philanthropy. Climate change is a global catastrophic risk. But I would also say that if I somehow learned that humanity had gone extinct or civilization had collapsed in the next 100 years, and I had to guess how, probably at the top of my list would be that there was some kind of pandemic, especially a pandemic that was made possible by synthetic biology, a kind of superbug or a custom bug. And, you know, I believe that the world is underprepared for that kind of thing, will be especially underprepared a decade or two from now when synthetic biology becomes easier to use. And so one of the things we've been doing with our staff there, Jamie Asif and Howie Lempel, has been, you know, looking for ways to get better prepared, to have governments paying more attention to the worst possible cases, to fund groups that are helping to think these things through and put the most important risks on the map and think through what those risks are. And so that's, you know, that's been a major focus for us. And then the final thing I'll mention before I take a break, potential risk from advanced artificial intelligence. So this cause is a bit of a mouthful just to say, and certainly a lot to get into, but it's another case where I think, you know, as a philanthropist, one way to have a big impact is to help the people, or in some cases the chickens, who are the most marginalized, who are the worst off, who are getting the least attention. Another way to have a big impact is to look at issues, at factors, at maybe X factors that could affect the whole planet, that could affect all of civilization at once. Climate change is one of them, a pandemic is one of them, and I think artificial intelligence is a third really huge one. I think that AI is probably one of the most dynamic and unpredictable areas of science right now. Over the last, you know, 4 or 5 years, we've seen artificial systems be able to do things that were previously thought to really be kind of human specialties, like being able to see and use your intuition to decide like what you're seeing in an image. Also, the board game Go, previously considered one of the hardest games for a machine to play, now has a machine world champion, and it kind of happened overnight. So, you know, I think it's a very interesting area of science, and I think it's very hard to say how far the current wave of innovation can go. But I do believe that, you know, the reason that humans have transformed the planet so dramatically and have so much more power and impact than other species is basically intelligence. And I think if you had something that had greater intelligence than humans in certain domains, like doing science, you might see a comparably dramatic contrast and a comparably dramatic transformation. And so, you know, my best guess is that if we get transformative artificial intelligence on the soon side, which I would say might be a couple decades or so, my best guess is that'll be a very good thing. And I can tell you many good things that might happen because of it. But there are also ways it could go wrong. And I think if you had, you know, if you had the wrong government or the wrong people sort of having a cutting edge AI that helped them to get a lot of the goals they have, that could be very bad. And also if you had an AI that had the wrong combination of being very intelligent, very powerful, but also buggy in some way, I think that, you know, this could be a long debate, but I think that could also be very bad, and bad on kind of on a planetary scale. Bad to the point where I think, even if I'm not totally sure what to do about it today, I would like to see society look a little bit more paranoid than it currently does, and be putting in a little more effort than it currently is to kind of raise questions. Is there research we could be doing today to make it less likely that we'll end up in a bad situation with AI in the future? And so there, Daniel Dewey's our full-time employee, and a bunch of the rest of us put in time, and we've been looking for both on the policy side and on the technical side, is there work we can be doing today to lay the groundwork, establish some ideas, and make it less likely that, you know, if and when we get transformative artificial intelligence, that it happens in a bad way. So that, that is an overview of what the Open Philanthropy Project does, who we are, what we've been doing. And with that, I'll take questions for a while, and then maybe at some point I'll talk about our plans for next year. Questions?
Mm-hmm.
So you talked about a bunch of different important causes, and it seems like there's a lot of hard challenges to solve in the world. And I guess I was just curious, to what extent is it an issue of having enough money to go towards those causes versus finding great people in the world who are able to work on them? I guess another way to phrase it would be like, is the incentive structure set up for great teams of people to come together and try to work on these problems? Or are they just going to go join Facebook or something like that?
Sure. Yeah. So to what extent is the challenge money, and to what extent is the challenge people? And to what extent, when we have these problems, these challenges facing humanity, is it more important that we spend enough money on them, or that we get the right people to work on these challenges and get them doing that instead of, I actually think some of the things you named are very good for the world, but I certainly think there are great people doing pretty useless things and just making a lot of money, and so which is the bigger problem? I would say the two are very interconnected. So without people, I think money is like mostly useless for a lot of the problems that I've talked about. And I would also say that a lot of the things that we try, a lot of what we try to do is make it easier for people to work on the problems we care about than to just work on things that are very industry dominated. A lot of what we've dealt with is kind of the feedback loop, because I think to give AI as an example, we look at a situation where kind of there's no real field that works on technical research around AI safety. It's kind of this nascent growing field. There's a bunch of people who work on AI, but there's almost no one who kind of works on AI with a particular slant toward trying to think about social impact and make things go well. And, it's kind of a tough thing because junior people don't want to work on this because they don't see a career path. And they don't see any professor they can work under, and they don't see any professor they can turn into. But professors don't want to work on this because they don't work on it, and it's not what they've done, and it's not where they're at. And so you get this kind of chicken and egg problem, and a lot of what we've been doing is just, finding anyone we can who is interested in working on these problems, make it as easy for them as we can, fund them when they're an academic and when we can fund them, and then by doing that, to also create common knowledge that there is money in this field, and that actually if you want to work on this stuff, you can get your salary paid, and then that hopefully brings in more people. And as more good people come in, then more people hear about it. And so I think it's I think it's the two are interrelated. I think that you can lead with money, and you can try to make it easier for people to switch, or you can lead with people, and you could have people raising money. But our comparative advantage is money, and so a lot of what we've tried to understand is how a philanthropist can change the human capital composition of an area and draw good people into a field, and it's not always that straightforward.
Mm-hmm. So the first two projects you mentioned are obviously those are very two different things. And I guess my question is, since you're sort of concerned about catastrophic risk, and the predictive nature means that there's going to be things you don't predict, and that could be the thing that wipes everyone out, how do you sort of account for that when you're making these different strategies and when you're planning ahead and thinking about what might happen?
Sure. I think the question is, how do we account for the fact that it's probably the things we're not thinking of that could derail a lot of the work we're trying to do, and that when we work on things this long term, and even to some degree criminal justice reform and farm animal welfare are very long term compared to giving out bed nets, for example, how do we deal with the risk of an unknown And, you know, I don't have any kind of, like, one systematic answer to that. I mean, I think one of the things we have to go into our work knowing is just that the future is very hard to predict, and that no plan is going to go exactly the way we wanted it to. You know, one thing I can say, I mean, I think there's a couple attitudes we bring to this work. One is the hits-based giving approach I mentioned earlier, which is that, you know, we don't expect to be able to see how everything's going to play out. But if our goal is more to have a really big win one time out of 10 than to have like a small win 10 times out of 10, I think it becomes more reasonable to say, hey, you know, we're going to try a bunch of things that could work, and hopefully some of them will work really big. And I would say another attitude we bring to our work is that we're less about planning exactly how things will go than we are about laying the groundwork to make good things easier to happen. So, you know, it's not, when we do our biosecurity and pandemic preparedness work, we don't have a year in mind and a pandemic in mind and exact thing that's going to happen. When we do our potential risk for advanced artificial intelligence work, it's also like that. But in both cases, we want there to be a more robust field. We want there to be a stronger set of institutions, a stronger set of people who are really experts, who are full-time, who think about these issues. And we feel that, you know, the difference between a world that has very few people who ever think about these things and that has to frantically improvise when something happens versus a world that has a lot of people who are steeped in the relevant issues all the time, we don't know exactly how things will play out, but we think the second world goes better than the first and with some reliability and you know, not just randomly. And I think the same is somewhat true in politics as well. I mean, I think a lot of the policy work we do is trying to put ideas into the conversation, put ideas on the table, get people into the dialogue, because a lot of times actual policy change happens for some unpredictable reason. Something hits the headlines and people are making a deal in Congress. But if you wait for that to happen and then you frantically try to get up to speed and try to get to the table, I don't think that's nearly as productive as in advance saying, what are the most important issues to work on? What are the best issues to work on? And how can we make sure that when there is a window of opportunity, that there's a lot of people and a lot of good organizations that are ready to quickly take advantage of it. Corner. Yep. Oh, hey, Eliza.
So I'm just curious from your perspective. I imagine there are a lot of things that GiveWell or OpenPhil doesn't fund because there is a natural sort of profit incentive to be funding them, and they're happening in the private sector. So what would you point to as the things that you're most excited about in terms of their potential benefit for humanity in happening in the private sector right now? And if the answer is just artificial intelligence, like which particular applications would you point to?
Yeah, what am I excited about for the future of humanity that we're not doing anything about because it's in the for-profit sector? I mean, that's definitely not a question I think about every day because we're so focused on the nonprofit stuff. I mean, you know, some things that I think are just robustly very good. Certainly, I think, you know, medical technology, energy technology, these are things that there are pretty good profit motives to work on and that are moving forward and that I'm happy are moving forward. I'm excited about, I don't know, recently had an Impossible Burger, which is this, you know, this kind of high-tech veggie burger that is designed to really taste and feel and just seem like a meat burger. You know, that's a for-profit, but if they're successful, then that will have huge implications, not only for animal welfare, but for the environment, for carbon emissions, for things like that. So that's exciting. Yeah, definitely AI is exciting. You know, specifically what in AI, I mean, I think in general, like being able to automate anything should hopefully at least make the pie bigger, produce more wealth, and then the question of how that wealth gets distributed, I think, can be something that rightly makes people nervous. I think that, you know, things like medical diagnosis can be made more accurate, perhaps education can be more customized, things like that. So, but it's not, yeah, it's not what I put the most time into, but I certainly, I do at the same time feel that, you know, a lot of the most exciting things that have happened and will happen are coming from the for-profit sector, and also a lot of the most exciting transformations happen because of policy change, and they come from government. So, you know, it's not, I don't really think philanthropy takes up the lion's share of good things that happen. I just think philanthropy has kind of a unique role to play, and it's the role that I spend my time thinking about. Mm-hmm.
So it struck me that you were talking about, on the one hand, sort of building networks of experts, of expertise, and on the other hand, building strong institutions. And the former, to me, seems much more tractable than the latter.
Uh-huh.
Specifically thinking about, you know, like we might expect a pandemic to originate in a place with weak institutions, like state institutions, like say Ebola is endemic in the
right.
Congo or Liberia. So when you're talking about organizations, institutions, what are you talking about? Is this just non-state, non-profit, maybe academic? Are you working with, you know, what kind of building governance capacity?
Sure. What kind of institutions do I have in mind, and do I feel that, you know, that it's really possible to strengthen those? So I should probably specify that I don't really mean institutions in the kind of like why nations fail sense of these kind of ethereal, you know, things that kind of pervade everything. I mean, I just don't really know how to make those better very much. So, you know, except by focusing on just more specific problems in the world. You know, so I think it really just varies by the cause. But a lot of times what I do have in mind is more like a network of really qualified people, nonprofits that know what they're doing, but also government agencies that know what they're doing and often get good advice or get people from nonprofits. And so certainly I think that is a dynamic we're hoping for example, in the biosecurity space. Other questions? Yep.
So you mentioned that you seek funding primarily through high net worth individuals. Do you feel your research area could be influenced by their preference? And do you feel it's beneficial to maybe be more open to the public to seek for suggestions and know what are people, what causes do people really care about?
Sure. So are we worried that we're going to be influenced by high net worth individuals that we work with? And would it be better if we were, you know, more public facing and sought a more diversified base of donors? I mean, I think, you know, on the second one, I think that whoever you're accountable to, there's always a risk that they're going to make you do things differently from how you would have done them yourself. Or maybe not a risk. Maybe that's a feature. I think in the case of the public, I mean, I do feel that, I think GiveWell has its approach and is very public facing, but I think there's also a place in the world for organizations that are about taking risks, doing what others won't do. And I think in a lot of ways, the world looks more diverse when the individual organizations are trying less hard to represent the world in all its diversity, if that makes sense. So in other words, if you have 100 organizations and each of them has their own unique worldview and their own unique sort of leaders and they're doing things their way, and then they all contribute ideas, and then you have this kind of marketplace of ideas, I think that's a much more robust and healthy and diverse world than if you have 100 organizations and they each kind of take a national vote on what they should do, for example. And so I do, you know, I basically feel like the core philosophy of OpenPhil is a small number of decision makers philosophy, and everything we do, every way we're structured, is about having a minimal number of decision makers, and it's not because we feel that we should be making all the decisions in the world. It's kind of the opposite. It's that actually there are a lot of other funders who have as much funds as we do, and we're not that huge a percentage of the total philanthropic capital. And so what we want to do is do something special and different and us, and do it with integrity. In terms of being influenced by the high net worths, I mean, I think we have a very good partnership with Carrie and Dustin, and the reason that we both chosen to work with each other is because we feel so aligned that we feel that, you know, we're learning from each other and helping each other to be a better version of ourselves, but there's not a lot of feeling of compromise and, you know, I'm only doing this because you want to. There is some of that, but I think it is, you know, it is limited, and I think we have quite purposefully, you know, we are selective. I mean, we wouldn't want to work with someone who had very different priorities from us. We're not a consultant. We look for people who have very similar goals and who we feel we can work with, you know, in a productive way that sticks with that kind of high integrity fidelity to a core vision. Yep.
What are organizations that you think are doing something similar to describe, if there are any?
Yep. What are organizations that do something similar to OpenPhil, if any? I think the most natural comparison to OpenPhil is other foundations. So other foundations, just like OpenPhil, they have a bunch of full-time people, they have a bunch of capital, and they spend their time trying to give away the capital to accomplish certain goals. I think the most, you know, noticeable differences between them, I would say, you know, other foundations, and I think it's accurate to just literally say all other foundations, they are explicitly there to serve their funders and to do what their funders find personally meaningful. And, you know, OpenPhil is much more set up as something to do the best thing we can, to help the world as much as we can. Now, obviously, help the world as much as we can often involves personal judgment calls, and there are times when you don't have any choice but to make a personal decision, but it's still a fundamentally different vision and a different mission to say, we are trying to help the world as much as we can, and we'll make the personal calls when we have to, than it is to say, you know, this is the, you know, Holden Foundation, and it's here for Holden, and it's here to do what appeals to Holden. So that's a fundamental difference in philosophy, and it also relates to the fact that I think we put out more and more detailed public content than other foundations, and it also relates to the fact that we've been, you know, very different in the way we've picked our focus areas than other foundations. So, you know, most other foundations and most other advice we get is to kind of pick focus areas from the heart without doing a lot of analysis on that, and then to get into the analysis. And we did a great deal of analysis to pick our focus areas. So those are differences. But in terms of the groups that are similar, I would say it's foundations. And there's a great variety in foundations. So I think, you know, there's no one doing exactly the same as we are with exactly the same vision, but there are a lot of other foundations doing great work of one kind or another, and, you know, sometimes there will be a lot of overlap in our methodology, or there will be overlap in an actual area, and that's certainly something that happens. I can take a few more, unless I've answered all the questions. Yep, Leah.
Anything happening in science?
Yeah, I didn't talk about science, so, you know, I simplified a little bit. I mean, we chose focus areas from kind of an initial pool, an initial couple of categories. So we chose policy focus areas and global catastrophic risk focus areas, and we haven't yet chosen science focus areas. That's just a long process, so, you know, understanding, thinking about what science is most important, neglected, and tractable requires a level of scientific knowledge that, you know, you get to the point where it gets very hard to kind of bridge all the way from expert scientists who know their field to kind of, you know, us and the decision makers and the donors. So it's just been an ongoing challenge. And, you know, I think we made a major step forward in August when we had two senior scientific advisors start, Chris Somerville and Heather Youngs. And so, you know, that was a search that took, I think, over a year. And so now we're definitely spending more time on science cause selection than we used to, but we're still at the point of kind of figuring out even what does the process look like for figuring out whether a scientific cause is important, neglected, and tractable, and what we want our priorities to be. I'm also going to make a quick remark, since I have time, on just where we are in our evolution. So I mentioned that first we kind of did cause selection, then we did hiring, then we did grant making. This was the first year that we really did, you know, a really large amount of grant making, and I think there was some question at some point about when we were going to reach that point, but I think, you know, as we've ramped up the grant making, we've run into a lot of questions and issues and challenges that, you know, either didn't occur to us before or didn't seem very salient or important before. So questions like, how do we know when a grant is good enough to make the grant instead of saving the money for later? That's something we've been largely going on intuition or on a few heuristics, and we want to develop kind of a more formal framework for it. And there will be a blog post with more thoughts on that probably in the next week or so. And then, you know, I think we can get our processes down better. I think a lot of the step-by-step process for making a grant, for getting different people on the team with different levels of expertise, like the experts on the same page as the decision makers, getting the money like to the recipient a lot of the time can be a surprising challenge, especially in working with universities. So I think there's just a whole bunch of questions that we just, you know, have kind of muddled through. And I want next year to be largely focused on just building more robust frameworks so that we're not only giving away a lot of money, but giving it in a way that seems like every part of the process has really been thoughtfully designed, and we can scale it as much as we want to, and then we can think about what other causes we want to add on and how we want to ramp up further. So with that, I'll take one or two more questions, and then I'll stop. Yep.
What sort of time frame do you look at for policy questions? And for the reason I ask is you mentioned federal, there being a lot of difficulties right now and focusing on criminal justice because of the state and local.
Yeah.
Is this something where, like, recent events have changed your time frame in general, or is it something where you want to do the work so far in advance that you're taking a long view and still not really changing your plans based on recent events?
Yeah, I mean, what kind of timeframes do we work on in policy? And, you know, by default, a lot of our policy issues are kind of we're trying to lay the groundwork in case something happens in the next 10 to 20 years. That's often the time frame we're kind of implicitly working with. Though the two causes I mentioned, I think, are significantly shorter time frames than that. I think there is actually a window of opportunity in criminal justice reform. And so, you know, we're hoping to actually see some impact in the next few years, and I think already have seen some impact. And farm animal welfare, I mean, I think the impact has been big, and we've seen it. And, you know, I don't know that it's so much a window of opportunity as more like a neglected cause that, you know, with resources, I think can go a lot further and a lot faster. So, you know, I will say, I mean, you asked whether recent events have changed the outlook, and it's still something we're thinking through. And I think they have changed elements of the outlook, but we definitely did try to pick causes that, you know, weren't going to... We wanted to pick causes that we could work in for a long time, because we had to pick them and then hire them and then learn about them and then do the grants. And then after doing the grants, the institutions that we're supporting have to build. And so, you know, everything we do is on a long time frame. So we really did try to pick causes where the case for them was very unlikely to vanish overnight. And I think it really hasn't vanished overnight. I mean, I think the prospects for criminal justice reform still look good at the state and local level, and that's always been where we're focused. And I think it, for all our causes, they all look still very worthwhile to me, even in light of, you know, whatever might have happened recently. Cool. If there's one more question, I'll take it. Otherwise, all right, too late. Is Kat here?
Yeah.
All right, cool. I'm going to hand it over to Kat. So thanks, everyone.